Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. Now, how's it going out there, all my Bitcoiners all around the world? Thanks for joining me again for another day here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Before we dive into this episode with Max Hillebrand, let's check in with Swan. Sign up for Swan's referral program. It's called the Swan Force. You can sign up at swanbitcoin.com/enlist. You can be anywhere in the world. You do not have to be a citizen of the United States, living in the United States, to join the Swan Force. Anywhere in the world, you can refer US-based customers and earn 25% of Swan's fees on every purchase made by your referrals for 3 years. And they get $10 of BTC, so everybody wins. Remember, you can join from anywhere in the world. Sign up US-based customers. We'll pay you in sats wherever you are. On Swan Signal Live next week, we have Robert Breedlove and Parker Lewis, two of the best writers in Bitcoin. That's going to get cosmic. And the following week, we have another monster of a show, the incredible Danielle DiMartino Booth. She's the author of Fed Up, a fantastic read. You should check it out if you haven't yet. And GigaChad himself, Michael Saylor, CEO of MicroStrategy. Get over to youtube.com/swansignal, subscribe, turn on the notifications, and you'll find the audio podcast at swansignalpodcast.com. Thanks as always to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. Subscribe to the LTBN feed for other great Bitcoin podcasts like Bitcoin und Co., Bitcoin Audible, and What Bitcoin Did. Shout out to the crew there at Bitcoin Magazine doing great work on every form of media. All right, let's dive in. Max Hillebrand is a true Bitcoiner. He practices what he preaches. Max is living the digital nomad life using Bitcoin, ruthlessly minimizing his exposure to fiat shitcoins. In this episode, we talk about his nomadic lifestyle, using Bitcoin as a unit of account, how to start getting paid in Bitcoin, base layer privacy, and philosophy. Here we go. All right, Max, I know you've been roaming the globe for the past year or so. Where are you right now, if you don't mind disclosing your location? Approximately.
Privacy is about selectively revealing yourself to the world. And there's some aspects that I am willing to share, specifically when there is some nice meat space activity going on, that I'm public there anyway. And that is currently the case. So right now I'm in Prague. First of all, the city is absolutely beautiful, and it was built in the golden times with under a solid gold standard, and you really see it in the architecture and in the life and in the vibe of the city. It's phenomenal, and specifically the individuals there. It's just such a strong community of principled thinkers and rational minds, and it's of doers, actually, specifically in parallel Nepolis. Which is this Bitcoin Coffee Hackerspace Institute of Crypto Anarchy. It's just a beautiful place to be. And whenever I'm close to Prague, I for sure stop by.
So does it seem like, you know, we have this idea of a sound money ethos, kind of the ethics and ideas, and even the sort of behavior that sound money induces in people. Does that feel like that sort of ethos is still present in Prague, or is there, some kind of fiat culture that has sort of instilled itself there, do you think?
So a couple things. First of all, you see it in the architecture, right? The buildings in Prague. I mean, wow. Really, it teaches you to look up. Because every wall of every building is just beautifully decorated and crafted with care and with just love, basically. And you see it in the city. It's great. Very creepy in autumn and very, very vibrational in spring. It's really a great place. Though I think you also see it on other aspects. One of these things where I just still see this great free marketeering going on in Prague is the Vietnamese community. They are actually quite many immigrants here. And what they have done is to become useful, right? And they provide a meaningful service, mainly running what is called a Vietnamese shop. So this is a small grocery store that literally has everything that you need. To survive in a city for months, you would be able to not go to any other store. And they are the beautiful thing about them is they are always in stock. They have a huge variety. Just their cash flow management and capital allocation is very, very good. There's never an empty shelf. There is not one empty cubic meter in the shop. It's stocked to the brim. And they're basically open 24/7. They basically live in there. They do have small apartments behind these stores. And there's always just a mother and her child hanging out in the store, cleaning up, stocking things, cashiering, and so on. So it's a very active doer kind of mindset. And therefore also the Vietnamese community is greatly respected with the individuals that I meet here in Prague, just because they provide such a super useful and valuable service. And I think that's just, might just be one random example picked here, but this is something really there. I see that golden age of entrepreneurship still prevalent.
That's really cool. So you have chosen very deliberately to live this life of nomadism. You're in Prague right now. I know you've, I think, been in East Asia for a while. I think it was Singapore, was it? Last time we talked on this podcast sometime last year.
That was in Taiwan, actually.
Taiwan, in November, right.
2019, that was a great time because we got together, all the Wasabikas working on the Wasabi Wallet code base, got together in Taiwan. We kind of like to do this yearly annual gathering with most of the contributors. And we stayed there for a month and we went to different cafes and different places and improved Wasabi and achieved quite a whole lot of awesome work there. It was a super productive time, like 16 hours a day, basically nonstop. And it was so much fun. but that was great.
So what have you learned from living this nomadic life? What are the positives and maybe some of the negatives that you've come across as well?
One thing that I really come to realize is the power of choice of where to wake up in the morning, because that really is a question that you have to ask yourself. What is the place that you really want to be at? Because when you're mobile in, for example, a truck or a car, you can be anywhere in Europe within the day, right? You can drive 1,000 kilometers in a day if you're willing. And that brings you quite many places. So the options that you have as an individual who is nomadic, who has his capital in a mobile way, this just means that that there are many, many more options that open yourself up. And then this is a compelling question of where do you want to be? Where do you actually want to wake up? And this really asks you to prioritize whom other individuals you want to collaborate with, and where specifically in meet space you want to manifest yourself in order to collaborate with these. Or if you're feeling like not seeing any monkeys at all and taking a break in the middle of nowhere, these are all of a sudden all options. And it is a constant struggle but also a constant thrill to choose where you actually want to be. And this is something very exhilarating and liberating. It's a very beautiful, indescribable feeling.
I bet. I can imagine. I did this for a little while right after college, and between college and then joined the Peace Corps. I had about 6 months, and so I traveled a lot around South America. I ended up being in Guyana, South America, which is a little actually English-speaking colony, former English colony. Up near Venezuela, on the border of Venezuela and Brazil. And so I traveled around in a lot of South America, and that was an absolutely, like you said, exhilarating time, just to be completely free to move about wherever you wanted to be and stay as long as you want in a certain place. And when it's ready to move on, you just make that choice and move on. And met so many amazing people, just had a lot of experiences that I still carry with me today, kind of lessons learned by, breaking out of the bubble, the American bubble, and getting a different perspective on the world. Max, you still there, man?
Oh, that was a new mistake.
Sorry.
I should unmute myself when blabbering.
Yes. Yeah. Go ahead.
Even after all these countless hours of videos and podcasts, I still make the mistake.
We all do, man. We all do. Yeah, we all do. It still happens every once in a while.
there are many positive sides to this traveling, but you also wanted to know about some negatives. And I think it's kind of the other side of the same coin. You on one hand, you really have the choice of being free in your manifestation and meat space, and you really can choose and be at the places where you really want to be. But the major downside is you are not going to be at any of the other places, right? Mm-hmm. There are so many potentials that you could go to, so many options, so many opportunities, but you can only choose one. And this means that you say no to so many people, so many places, so many events, and so many happenings. And that is very difficult too, right? Specifically when you have traveled for a while and you've really built this global tribe of contributors and individuals that Fight belongs to. And then you still have to put most of them off when they invite you to places or just in general, you will not see them for a while. And that can be quite devastating. You know that, for example, another thing is family, right? If you travel mm-hmm. quite a lot your parents or siblings or cousins or whatnot are in a completely different place, it's not nice to see them or to not see them for such a long time. And these are all different trade-offs and something that has to be considered because there's always, positives and negatives to it.
Yeah, that's true. Do you think that a Bitcoin-based world would change our ability in any way to, or even incentive to live a nomadic life?
I think so, yes. And I think so because I've experienced it myself, mm-hmm. that Bitcoin is a phenomenal tool that I as a nomad can use to further enhance that aspect of being mobile while not sacrificing any of the costs. If you don't want to have a bank account, which is obvious, then if you travel, you have to carry all the cash physically in the fiat realm, and that is a huge risk, right? And at borders, there might be checks, and there might be burglars and looters trying to steal at any situations, and that's not nice to defend against. And this is something where Bitcoin thrives at and excels at, right? Because you just have it securely protected, either encrypted on your laptop. Or even in a hardware wallet, like hidden in a secure physical place, or you just memorize your mnemonics even. These are all possible options to travel with your money without it being noticed by outside observers. And that is super, super powerful, right? Specifically when crossing borders, you can carry a huge amount of capital with you on an airplane with Bitcoin, right? But try to carry like half a kilo of gold. Well, good luck.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So have you been living on Bitcoin as much as possible while you've been traveling around the world?
Well, so over these last couple of years, I've more and more as an entrepreneur demanded to be paid in Bitcoin. So I encouraged my clients to pay me in Bitcoin and I charged them extra if they dared to pay me in fiat into the fiat shitcoin offloading facility, which I'm obviously not. It's not my business. So I charged them extra for that service. And then now, like a year ago or so, I was at the point where I just said, no, if you want to pay me in fiat and you really insist on it and you cannot pay me in Bitcoin, then I will not work with you. That sucks for you. I'm sorry. Come back if you have Bitcoin and you're willing to give them to me. And so this means that all of my clients now do pay me in Bitcoin. And further, I've convinced most of them to denominate the contracts in Bitcoin. So there's a certain amount of satoshis that I earn every hour. And I don't care what the fiat exchange rate does in that time frame. If it's a yearly contract, then I earn the same amount of sats throughout the year.
That's fantastic, man. So what reactions have you had from clients where you've demanded to be paid in satoshis? Have you had anybody get annoyed or, act in some way like just angry even with that you're demanding, to be paid in this magic internet money?
Well, in the beginning, for sure, most everyone said no, obviously, which kind of sucks because it reduces the amount of clients that I could potentially work for, right? It reduces the demand for my services, which means that the price also decreases that I can charge. So that was a very difficult choice as an entrepreneur, really, to go all out, because it just limits your client base, right? And it's much, much more difficult to find your market, and obviously also to earn money, right? And even earning fiat shitcoins, you know, if very soon you change it into Bitcoin, that's still good because you get more Bitcoin. That aspect of, like, it's totally understandable to say, okay, we'll just continue working in the fiat realm and earn fiat and just exchange it as fast as possible to Bitcoin. That's probably a very profitable strategy. But for me, that just was not an option out of first principles. I'm a radical individualist and I'm not going to steal from others. And specifically demanding to be paid in fiat and holding your wealth in fiat means that you are earlier in the Cantillon effect than billions of other individuals. And therefore, you steal from all of them. This is a wealth transfer from those who receive newly printed money later to those who receive newly printed money first. You're for sure not the first in this chain, so you're being stolen from too. But nevertheless, you still steal from others and take their capital without their consent. And that's something that was just for me not acceptable. And therefore, I was willing to take this extra risk and to carry these additional costs of fully opting out just because there is no other option for me.
So if you do have to pay in fiat for a meal or groceries or something like that or a place to stay, how do you handle that?
So in general, my goal is to reduce the number of seconds that I hold any meaningful quantity of fiat shitcoins. And it's even in that short time period where I do hold a small amount, I see it as a fun coupon, basically. It's a casino chip, right? So I know that I want to buy, let's say, for $50 a nice steak in a restaurant. I know that the merchant only accepts fiat. He does not demand to be paid in Bitcoin. Well, first of all, he's a fucking idiot and he's going to lose out on quite a huge deal for him. But okay, I don't have time to convince him. So then I sell some of these Bitcoin and I buy basically the fiat shitcoin, but only with the intent to further use it as to buy the stake. So for me, fiat is a medium of exchange. It's something that I buy in order to buy something else. But it for sure is not my money in the sense of unit of account and store of value.
Yeah. I think that's fantastic, man. Have you come across any other Bitcoiners that are living this lifestyle to the extent that you are at this point?
Oh, yes, for sure. I'm absolutely not the first and not the most extreme either. Felix Weiss, for example, if I remember correctly, but that might be wrong, in 2012 or something, he went on a tour to live on Bitcoin and traveled the world. And did the same. So he did not have a bank account. He only had Bitcoin. And in whatever country he traveled to, he exchanged a small portion of his Bitcoin for the local shitcoin, whatever the monkeys used over there. And then he bought his goods and services and was happy. Right? But his wealth was protected in Bitcoin. And he only took a very short term and limited exposure to the risks that the fiat empire has.
Right. I find that fascinating, man, and respect it very much. I mean, myself, I'm really only using it as a store of value at this point. Absolutely hope to be paid in Bitcoin at some point and really should make a concerted effort to make that happen, I think. What do you think about this idea of a circular economy? It's been going around, quite a bit. There are certainly Bitcoiners who are strong advocates of building a circular economy as fast as possible in Bitcoin as a sort of a way to create a hedge against state attack, I guess you could say, to have an economy that is fully functioning outside of the fiat system. What are your thoughts on establishing a circular economy?
Oh, it's absolutely important, right? Because it's at the core of entrepreneurial action. You have income, right? Meaning you provide a valuable service or good to clients and they give you money for it. So this is your income. And then you have expenses, meaning you need to buy stuff so that you can build the stuff that you sell, right? You need to get the raw materials, the labor, the land, the time, and all of this in order to build the good that you're selling. So this is a circle, right? You have inflows, you have outflows, and the net is your profit. And that is what the entrepreneurs should strive for, right? That profit, that value creation. And why is this so important to have a fully Bitcoin economy in this sense? Is because it helps you with resource allocation, right? So when, for example, you get exactly one Bitcoin in exchange for a service from your client, this means that you now have one out of 21 million, and that percentage of the total money supply is absolutely yours. So out of the entire resources in the Bitcoin economy, every entrepreneur who demands to be paid in Bitcoin for exchange for whatever services, all the coffees, all the Lambos, you know, everything that you can buy with Bitcoin, you own now one over 21 million of it. So that small percentage of everything that is currently available on the market is yours, basically, in that certain moment. And this is purchasing power, right? And now you know exactly how much of all the resources in the economy you can control. And now you can actually choose and decide, now which of the resources do I want to buy and how do I want to control them, right? Specifically with the goal to build a beautiful and useful product for other individuals, right? To further the production stages of raw materials into more refined goods and services. And then to offer this final product to your customer, who again will pay you something, right? And now you can compare the cost that you had, right? Let's say 0.5 Bitcoin out of 21 million, right? This is the cost that you had. And if the client pays you one Bitcoin out of 21 million, then you have a profit of 0.5 Bitcoin out of 21 million, right? So at any time, when you are in the circular economy, you always have the percentage of the total resources in the Bitcoin economy that you can control. And this is so incredibly useful for resource allocation. This is what entrepreneurial judgment is based on, right? What percentage of the resources do you control and how ought you to best allocate them?
Yeah, absolutely. That makes perfect sense to me. So what do you think are the methods that we can employ to bring about a circular economy sooner than later?
Well, you know, first and foremost, demand to be paid in Bitcoin. And you know, seriously, I mean, that should be pretty obvious advice, actually.
Yep.
you know, because who wants to get that fiat shit? And you know, two things. So first is, of course, the payout mechanism. So are they going to send you fiat to your bank account or are they going to send you Bitcoin to your address? So, right, these are basically the two options. And here, obviously, Bitcoin is preferable for obvious reasons, right? You don't have to worry about the hassle of converting the fiat back to Bitcoin. And then the other aspect, though, and that is so important, and I want to highlight this, is it's so, so, so bad to denominate your contracts in the fiat shitcoin. So if you say for a one-year period, I'm going to give you this amount of labor for whatever consulting service or whatnot that you do, and throughout the whole year, you're going to pay me $10,000 every month, right? For example, if you did this contract in the beginning of 2020, right, January, and you would have waited 3 months afterwards. By then, the monetary base of the global fiat shitcoin on a global level, not just one local shitcoin, but all the fiat shitcoins combined, their base money, their federal balance sheet and cash reserves increased by 30% in 3 months. Meaning all of a sudden, instead of having 10,000 out of 10 billion or whatever the number of current shitcoins they have, all of a sudden you have 10,000 out of twice as or 50% as much, 30% as much, sorry. So immediately the percentage of the of the monetary base that you receive in exchange for your value has decreased by 50%, right?
Yeah.
It's absolutely fucking insane. So if you denominate your contracts in this shitcoin, and you especially long-term contracts, if you're being stolen from every second that you still have that contract. And that's why it's so important to use a sound monetary asset as your base economic calculation, because otherwise, if you don't, if others have the power to inflate and to increase the money supply underneath you, you are going to make massive mistakes in your resource allocation. And you're going to invest your time, which is your most precious capital, and your money, right, into completely bogus and wrong projects. And that's going to cost you so much. And not just you, but also generations after you, right? Like your grandchildren are going to be appalled if they realize that you still demanded to be paid in fiat while Bitcoin was already in existence. They're like, what the fuck are you doing? You idiot. This cost us literally a spaceship.
I hear you. Yeah. One thing that that strikes me that that can be done too. Like if you are in a world where most things are still fiat denominated and your employer won't pay in Bitcoin, and you won't, your mortgage payment or, you know, your health insurance payments or whatever aren't, you know, payable in Bitcoin either. One thing you can do is, you know, just set up a monthly or daily or weekly, you know, DCA and just turn as much of that into possible as is possible into Bitcoin. So you're effectively getting paid in Bitcoin, and, you know, and then paying out your bills in, you know, your fiat bills, you know, in real time as you get your paycheck. You know, you send those payments out automatically as soon as paychecks come in, and then the rest of all your savings goes into Bitcoin. And you can also do the same with, you know, you know, basically like demanding, like you have, that, you know, that your vendors, you know, that you might use to, you know, complete your work, tools and services that you might use as an entrepreneur, you know, accept payments in Bitcoin. And I think that that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, eventually the, you know, fundamentals of sound money will assert itself on that end of the spectrum as well. And, you know, all entrepreneurs and service providers and product makers will eventually be, you know, demanding to be paid in Bitcoin, for, you know, for the, based on the principles of sound money, as that becomes more widely known.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Right. And also, as you said, the aspect of paying your suppliers in Bitcoin. This is something that for me was so, so important. Because, you know, I like to say that I'm an honest businessman and that I don't try to steal from my business partners and the people that I collaborate with. But I want to be true to these words, right? And if I give someone a fiat shitcoin, it's like literally drawing a pile of shit in front of their house. I mean, they don't really want that. It's just going to bring a bunch of hassle. And any second that they hold it, they're being stolen from, right? So it's like, I'm not going to give, like, if my counterparty has provided me a valuable service that was actually useful to me and where I drove a tremendous benefit, if I exchange for him in fiat, that's so disrespectful. Like, that's really just a slap in the face. So for me, it's like, I want to collaborate with individuals on like a sound principles and like good ethics. And denominating contracts in fiat and to make payouts in fiat is just the absolute opposite. So this is why I'm a big proponent of paying all my contractors in Bitcoin, like multiple people. And this has also been a tremendous success, because again, if you offer to hire someone in a Bitcoin denominated contract, that's a huge offer. Like, you're gonna get the best talent. Right, because everyone wants to have Bitcoin, so you're actually in a strong position. Right, you can really choose from the highest quality of entrepreneurs to provide whatever good or service that you want, and that is a really beneficial aspect. So I saw this, for example, with the Wasabi documentation, which is something that I started about a year ago, a bit more, and pretty early on, I talked to CK Snacks, the company who's working a lot on Wasabi, and was like, hey. We have revenue that's denominated in Bitcoin, right? And we earn from Bitcoin users. We ought to give some back to building the community. And because CK Snacks is such a plethora of and like such a beautiful, beautiful company, they agreed to have a monthly budget, roughly 0.1 Bitcoin, every single month to pay for the people who contribute to the documentation of the Wasabi wallet. And I was the one maintaining the documentation and in charge of these funds. So I, as an entrepreneur, had regular invoices or regular inflows from the company, like that budget to maintain and to allocate to the suppliers that I had, which were the contributors to the documentation. So anyone opening a pull request to add some new content or to fix some typos, or anyone making reviews and suggestions on how to further improve it and so on. All of these people who did some work were the suppliers that I paid out in Bitcoin. And that has really led to the Wasabi documentation being such a monumental piece of work by now over 30 contributors, really like hundreds of pages if you would print it out in a book form. And I think it's a tremendous success, again, because it attracts strong entrepreneurs and because it has this underlying respect of seeing your collaborating partner as someone heroically who actually provides you a meaningful service.
Yeah. So what do you think about the spending half of the circular economy equation? And what I think is probably the greatest hindrance to spending Bitcoin, the tax question.
Oh yeah.
What do you think about, you know, the taxes on Bitcoin as a commodity, you know, short in the US short term tax rates are, you know, average of 30%, 25-30%. Long-term capital gains taxes are 15%, and that's applicable to every transaction, even tiny transactions, which is utterly ridiculous, but is a legal truth in this country. What do you think about that, and you know, how that can be approached, I guess?
Being a slave to the US empire is quite not nice. So obviously it's not pretty to being stolen from to such a huge extent. And I mean, it's happening on so many levels. If you add up all the taxes, you're going to be at like 95% or something. And then we haven't even started talking about inflation, which is a hidden tax as well. You barely have any private property. Unfortunately, your slave masters loot quite a lot from you. And that sucks. That very much sucks. Bitcoin fixes this. It's very difficult to steal Bitcoin. Even for the US empire. So of course they're going to have roll up the whole bureaucracy and everything to make your life a huge trouble. But nevertheless, they cannot steal your Bitcoin. You actually have to sign a transaction and give it to them. So that's a monumental improvement to individual defense. And I hope very much for the sake of America that individuals use this weapon to stop the ongoing tyranny.
Agreed, man. Agreed. There is, you know, the fear of obviously physical retribution against Bitcoiners. And we have, you know, Bitcoin is mostly flown under the radar of the U.S. empire, as you put it. And they, you know, it has not been perceived as a threat. At least that appears to be the case. That will change in the coming years at some point. On the positive side, we do see Bitcoiners, or at least Bitcoin-friendly politicians emerging at both the federal and state levels. Wyoming has instituted some, you know, much friendlier Bitcoin laws than have existed in other states like New York, which is absolutely ridiculous, punishing laws against Bitcoin. You know, there's several federal politicians who have said very nice or good things about Bitcoin, positive things about Bitcoin in the actual, you know, chambers during public discourse, political discourse. And we have some regulations that have come down this year. You know, U.S. banks are now legally able to custody Bitcoin, for instance, which is a big deal for a lot of institutions who would like to move their treasury assets over to Bitcoin, or at least have, you know, high net worth individuals who want to invest in Bitcoin, and even just regular individuals who want to, who still have trust in their banks and more than maybe a Bitcoin native, you know, exchange. So those are positive developments. And I do see a political path forward where, Bitcoiners, you know, if there's some, there's a loud minority of Bitcoiners who demand to, you know, Bitcoin to be treated in a more fair way, maybe, you know, start with transactions under a certain dollar amount in Bitcoin value, or even better, under a certain Bitcoin denominated amount, like 0.1 Bitcoin. Anything under that is treated as a currency, taxed as, you know, not taxed because it's a transaction made with a currency. I think that's a, you know, a way to start. And I do see, like, through the political process, potentially a peaceful transition into at least citizens being able to hold Bitcoin legally, if not, you know, eventually the, you know, death of the Federal Reserve. Not sure that will happen politically. I think that'll happen just by the, you know, economically, by economic factors and the truth, again, of sound money. That's sort of my take on it in the United States. I'm sure it's similar in other, you know, governments around the world as well.
Yes, I do think that that's quite a similar trend in difference of these nation states. Though for me, always that argument that if just many people use Bitcoin and there's a majority out there who use this tool, that it will not be censored at that point, right? That the looters will not try to steal it. And I don't see much reason in that argument, actually. I mean, look back at Order 6102, right? There, people, like a huge majority of US population was holding gold, like a huge majority. And the network effect of gold was quite a couple of years by then, right? So it's very popular to use gold. But still, governments banned it. Why? Well, because governments always ban what is popular. That's why they haven't banned Bitcoin so far, because it is not popular. But as soon as it hits a certain threshold, as soon as actually the quantity of capital that is out of the reach of these looters gets significant for them, that they notice it, that they can all of a sudden steal much, much less, then they will really focus on stealing more Bitcoin, because parasites rely on stealing capital. And if the fiat empire is dwindling, then they will seek other means to get it. And that includes harassing Bitcoiners and trying to steal from them. But again, Bitcoin is black market money. Bitcoin doesn't give a fuck. Even if governments say that it is illegal, blocks will be continued to be produced, right? And valid transactions will continue to be confirmed. This is what makes Bitcoin different. It does not rely on the approval of the government. It does not care if it is legal or illegal. Bitcoin just does what it does.
Yeah. There are... you know, as we already mentioned, you work with Wasabi Wallet, and you are obviously committed to privacy. And I suspect that one of the reasons for that is this threat from the American Empire, even around the globe, and individual nation states as well that are, you know, not America, that they pose a threat to Bitcoiners. So privacy is an important defense against that potential attack against Bitcoiners. Is that one of the main reasons why you are so committed to, you know, privacy as an individual and also as a service to other Bitcoiners?
So my line of reasoning here was back in the days when I was using Hidden Wallet, it was working all right. There were a couple major bugs, but still it was working. But I saw anonymity set to users registered for CoinJoin. And then I realized that, okay, even though that this tool might work perfectly on the technical level, there's a network effect involved. The more users, the higher the anonymity set of a CoinJoin transaction, the better the privacy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's if I wanted to get good privacy with this tool, other users need to use it. And that was my realization back then. And this is why I started to do educational materials on Wasabi. Because that was the videos related to the written documentation and a bunch of podcasts and so on, and the direct user support. So it's again an individualistic realization to that problem of... not having enough privacy for myself, but it also is just that aspect that I want to have more division of labor in this economy, and I want to have sovereign individuals who actually defend themselves and who are productive with their capital, right? Who don't get 95% of everything that they own stolen on a yearly basis. That is not nice, right? So I want to give these tools to other individuals and to educate them on how to use it. Not just that my own privacy increases, but also that their own defenses increases, which will mean that they will be more productive in general and provides more value to society and the economy as a whole.
Yeah. So what is the latest development with Wasabi? And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, Wasabi versus Samurai and the approaches that are, you know, the differences between the two approaches, and, you know, also just how effective in general you think coin joining is in whatever method, and obviously compare both of the methods in efficacy in your view. But, you know, can we rely in general on coin join to maintain privacy in the state that it's in now, and what is coming down the line? I know there's a lot of questions. I'll repeat them if we need it. But what's coming down the line on the base layer and subsequent layers that will help improve privacy? And how soon do you think they'll be here?
Yeah. So I think. So first of all, the Bitcoin protocol at its basis fundamentally is extremely private. It has very, very many aspects where individuals can selectively reveal themselves. However, there is some skill and some nuances involved in articulating that power of choice properly on the protocol level too. And to not make a mistake that all of a sudden links all of your pseudonymous identities, your Bitcoin addresses, together. Mm-hmm. And so Bitcoin, even without advanced technologies like coin joins, can be used very, very privately. However, there are some improvements that specifically a coin join transaction can make, meaning it is a more proper break of the link between pseudonymous identities. So when it was clear that this certain coin belonged to you, like with address 123, and then you do a coin join and you receive address 567, this is much, much more difficult to cluster these two identities together. And CoinJoin is a very successful technique for this. Nothing new, articulated back in the archives of Bitcoin talk, probably in 2010. And then finally, Gregory Maxwell proposed a very well-articulated thoughts on this subject in 2013. And then multiple implementations since. I think right now, Zero-Link is on the cryptographical coordination model, the best that we have right now implemented, and the coordinator learns rather little information about the entire transaction. Though there are still some major downsides to that type of coin join coordination. And this is where new research comes in. And there's plenty of research going on and in so many different areas, including outside of the Bitcoin space, by the way. We started a Wasabi Research Club a year and a half ago. And we just sat together weekly and got some homework and read some academical papers and mm-hmm. even some code to understand certain privacy tools and then discuss the benefits and the downsides and the trade-offs. And we also looked at a bunch of other projects out there, like Monero, obviously, even Bcash research was in there. And we really took a very eclectic array of view. For a long time, many months, until we realized that, or we crystallized the things that we want to have out of a coin join algorithm and ceremony, but we realized that it wasn't out there. So we somehow tried to build it ourselves, and with some great suggestions by Jonas Nick, a Blockstream cryptographer, we came up with what is now Wabi Sabi, which is a new coin join ceremony has some very beautiful cryptography happening under the hood that enables very secure and very private or anonymous, for this matter, communication with the server who coordinates mm-hmm. the coin join. And I see a very large potential in future use cases that this flexible coin join protocol will enable.
Cool. What are the differences between the way Wasabi approaches coin joining and versus Samurai?
On the base layer, the cryptographic protocol used to coordinate the coin join is the same. The zero-link fungibility framework, which was authored by Adam Fiskor and later co-authored by TDFD. This work was actually a joint work from Wasabi and Samurai, or what is now Wasabi and Samurai. At that time, neither of these projects existed, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. This again relies back on what Gregory Maxwell explained in the paper with the Schnorr blind signature coin join. One of the aspects here is that every user has to have an equal amount denomination. This is on the cryptographic layer. The only reason why the cryptographic communication with the server is private in Zero-Link is because every user has exactly the same value. It is not possible on the communication layer to change these values to arbitrary values. This is, by the way, one of the things that we improve on with Wabi Sabi, because now on the communication layer, it does not matter what input or what output you register, at whatever value, it is completely anonymous against the coordinator and he cannot link the two together, which is great. This enables us to set custom amounts in a coin join, right? So instead of everyone sending 0.1234, everyone can send a bit differently and make a payment inside a coin join, right? This is something that I'm super, super interested about for future development, because currently all coin join implementations are, well, no, other than join market actually, but specifically, okay, let's say all zero link implementation, both Wasabi and Whirlpool are making a payment to the cell, to the same user. So the user controls both the input and the output of this coin join transaction. And it's not a payment transaction for a good or a service, right? So it's not that a user pays 1.23 Bitcoin to buy a Lambo, but he mixes to himself, basically.
And that interesting.
Has quite some on-chain costs, right? Because if you want to make a payment, this means first you make a coin join to yourself, maybe you make a second coin join to yourself, and then you make the transaction, the payment transaction. So you have three transactions in total, and that consumes a lot of block space. And this is maybe also one of the things where Wasabi and Samurai differ. Wasabi tries to optimize for block space efficiency, because block space is an extremely scarce resource. And this is why in Wasabi there were two things chosen. First is a large anonymity set size. So in every transaction there is 100 users, which means that already in this one single transaction you get quite a sufficiently large anonymity set. And this is cheaper than doing 10 transactions that give you 10 anonymity set, right? So having one transaction with 100 is cheaper than 10 with 10. This is one of the reasons that Wasabi does. Or also there's a concept called multi-denomination mixing that is implemented in Wasabi but not in Samurai. And that basically means that within the same coin join, there are multiple equal denomination pools. So in Wasabi, it's 0.1, 0.2, 0.4, 0.8, 1.6, 3.2, exponentially growing to whatever amount users provide in the inputs and outputs of the transaction. And this has another benefit of basically payment batching, right? So instead of having one transaction that has only the 0.1 pool and a different transaction that has only the 0.2 pool, what we can do is what's called transaction batching. And this is an extremely block space efficient technique. Because of two things. First, there's a minor improvement with transaction overhead, because details like the transaction ID are amortized amongst more inputs and outputs. But second, more importantly, the quantity of change UTXOs is reduced, and the UTXO set of every wallet is reduced compared to when we're not doing batching. And the UTXO set size in Bitcoin is one of the critical scaling aspects that we really have to treasure. So these two things, large anon set and multi-denomination mixing, were chosen in Wasabi precisely all of the reason that block space is so scarce and so valuable and that we have to allocate it efficiently and we cannot waste it.
Yeah. So Snor signatures should help on this front too. Make the base layer transactions even more private. Is that right? Because we can aggregates all of those transactions into a single signature, or is that am I misunderstanding that?
You're partially right. There, with the general idea of Schnorr signatures, there are multiple things possible. First is what is called public key aggregation and signature aggregation within one input. So this is what is MUSIC. Basically, it's a multi-signature algorithm where we have three people: Alice, Bob, Charlie. And each of them has their individual unique private key and individual unique public key. And now they share the public key with each other and create one aggregated public key. Okay? So out of three public keys, they aggregate one. And now if they want to produce a signature for this one public key, each three of them has to produce a signature with their individual private keys to produce that individual signature. And then in a collaborative multi-part process, they can create a aggregated signature that is valid for this aggregated public key. And the aggregated signature can only be valid if all three of the three, Alice, Bob, Charlie, have signed the same message.
Sure.
And this part of what we can do with Schnorr signatures is in Taproot, okay? So this aspect to aggregate public keys of one input, right? So we still have one UTXO, and it's just not a multi-signature UTXO with three public keys on the chain. It's just a single signature UTXO with one single aggregated public key and one aggregated signature. And we can do that with Taproot, and it's great. It improves privacy and scalability for more advanced contracts, like just multi-sig to protect your cold storage, Lightning Network, vault constructions, whole bunch of stuff. It's awesome. But it does not help as much with CoinJoin, because in CoinJoin, we're not doing multi-signatures anyway. That's way too complicated with the coordination. Although it's in theory possible, just difficult to implement at scale. And so what you spoke is cross-input signature aggregation. So right now in a coin join, we have, let's say, 100 inputs, right, and 100 outputs. And each input is controlled by a different person, Alice, Bob, Charlie, David, so on. And each of them has a private key and a public key. And that UTXO is locked up to the public key. And now they build an unsigned transaction that has the inputs and the outputs. And now everyone signs this transaction with his own individual private key. And then we have one message, the transaction, and 100 signatures over the same message, right? And this is the final transaction that can be broadcast and be confirmed in the Bitcoin network. And where cross-input signature aggregation comes in is when we have 100 users providing 100 inputs with 100 different public keys, right? They aggregate to one aggregated public key, and now they provide a signature, a one aggregated single signature that can only be true if all 100 individual private keys have signed. And this is where cross-input signature aggregation brings a huge fee savings for coin joins, because instead of having 100 inputs and 100 signatures, we have 100 inputs and one signature, right?
Yeah.
So this is where the fee savings comes in, but this is not a part of Taproot. So we will not get that any...
Gotcha. Anytime soon?
More than 2 weeks for sure.
More than 2 weeks. I love it. So you seem to be like a very ethically principled person. And you've studied philosophy and ethics, and have, you know, taken those, just as you have with Bitcoin, taken those practices to heart and really instilled them as part of your everyday life. What are some of your biggest philosophically speaking and ethically speaking?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think as with many, I have always had this fire of freedom burning inside my heart. And I, even from a very young age, though I at that time did not yet have the understanding of the subject and could not articulate it as well. And of course, there my family and my mother and father have a tremendous effect on me, obviously. And they have been very freedom loving in their raising of me. Which I think they've done quite a decent job. Though then more and more I discovered specifically economics and specifically praxeology in Austrian economics. This kind of has hooked me for so many years now, like much, much more than Bitcoin even. Like the Bitcoin rabbit hole is probably almost nothing compared to the Austrian rabbit hole that I went through. Bitcoin is quite intense too. This really shaped also my ethical understanding, because praxeology, and that is including Austrian economics, is just based on these solid first principles, and so reasonable and so rational in its argument, that it really is a very general view to look at many, many things, basically everything in the realm of human action. And this has been a huge, huge, huge impact on me, and specifically Murray Rothbard. I remember to his day, the first time that I read a book from Murray Rothbard was For a New Liberty, a New Libertarian Manifesto. And this I started reading at 8 o'clock in the evening in my hammock. And I remember that I finished reading it for the first time at 3 a.m. the same night. I just didn't move and I read nonstop. When I got to that point, I realized, okay, I've read it. I get it. I will instantly read it again. So I went back to page one and read the whole thing again in the same night. Skipped university the next day and read more from Rothbard because it was like, wow, finally, someone has put it, this entire monumental construction of individual liberty, this entire colossal monument of meaning, so beautifully and so succinctly based on solid first principles and absolutely rigorous in the following logic and conclusion, that it is, for me, irrefutable.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, it's nice when you discover that. It's very reassuring to find a philosophy that works from first principles that you can really believe in and trust its correctness, right? It's almost like a mathematical or scientific approach to understanding human action. And it's something that really changed my outlook on the world coming from, you know, being, you know, a default fiat world that I was raised in and grew up in. You know, discovering that was one of the things about Bitcoin, the rabbit hole that really changed my perspective about the world, not just economics, but also philosophy and human behavior and the right way to act, you know, or a correct way to act. It has an impact on all of those aspects of your life. And it's fundamentally an economic idea, just like long-term thinking, long time preference, high time or low time preference thinking is, you know, it's fundamentally an economic idea in terms of appreciating the value of your time in a different way. But it has these, you know, fundamental effects on behavior and outlook that I think are fascinating. It seems to be that you're describing something similar here. Is that the case with your life? I mean, did you feel sort of your outlook change? I know with you, it happened at a really young age, so I don't know if that would be the case. To me, it happened later in life after a lot of those ideas were kind of cemented. And so I felt the change, I think, maybe more viscerally than you did at such a young age.
So one thing for sure is that aspect of confusion that I had when first discovering, first standing in front of the problem of what is economics, what is entrepreneurial action, like how do we provide value, how do we create something? This was a huge question for me with a lot of uncertainty, and I started that rabbit hole down also through the Keynesian mainstream approach, right, the default, and I was so confused and so like it felt so weird because I didn't get it. Like it was just so not clicking for me. It was completely illogical. And I could not articulate why it was that like that. I couldn't find out why it is that it just does not make sense to me at all. And eventually I kind of came to that conclusion that there are two options. Either I'm just absolutely stupid and don't get it, or not just the logic inside the model, but the entire foundation of the model of Keynesian economics is fundamentally flawed. And it's just, it's completely broken, completely useless, like negative and counterproductive to a big extent. And this is when I then reached out for different schools of thoughts in economics. And I discovered scholastics and Milton Friedman and Hayek and Mises and Rothbard eventually. And this is where finally it clicked for me because, you know, in Keynesian professors, they just teach you these same shitty models and these same shitty graphs that everyone else, but nobody talks about why and what it actually means. But it looks nice and pretty, But it was just always such a huge point of conflict for me that I was like, no, but why? But what? No, what? No. And finally, with economics, with Austrian economics, with praxeology, there was a point where it was really just completely out of that. It was not at all in this realm of illogic and inconsistency and wrong assumptions. And I remember so much reading the first time Human Action, and the way that Mises starts that entire treatise with just explaining methodological approach of praxeology, what it means to have first assumptions, first axioms, first principles, right? That these are actually things that we cannot prove, right? First of all, to understand that, right? What actually an axiom is. For example, the mathematical axiom of two parallel lines never meet. You cannot prove it, right? It's impossible to prove logically, actually. That's why it's called a mathematical assumption. We assume that it is true, although we cannot prove it. And then based on this assumption, we build more advanced logic on top. And if our assumption is correct and the logical steps are reasonable and not illogical, then our outcome, the conclusion, must be correct too, right? Mm-hmm. And just that Mises explained that aspect. He does a phenomenal job in Theory and History, a great book, by the way. He explains it even better. And this is really when it clicked for me that, okay, this is not just a change within the Keynesian model. This is something fundamentally different. And Mises starts that explanation in a way that no other economics professor would. Like, no other economics professor nowadays would ever dare to write hundreds of pages in his economics textbook about philosophy and methodological approach. Right, that is completely unreasonable for Keynesians, because why would you ever waste yourself on discussing this low level in the methodological stack?
Yeah. What book, single book, would you recommend to a Bitcoiner who is listening to this right now? Maybe they're relatively new, maybe not, and they haven't kind of dived into the source material at all. What one book would you recommend as a place to start in understanding praxeology and the fundamental ideas of Austrian economics?
Oh man, that's such a, like, that's an impossible question to answer. Seriously,
yeah.
Book? No, first of all, Human Action, right? That's like, that book has everything. It's so good. It's so, so, so good, right? So that is for sure a candidate. But then Man, Economy, and State is, in my opinion, even better than Human Action. Like, it's much more thorough and fixes some logical flaws that Mises has in Human Action. So mm-hmm. Man, Economy, and State from Rothbard is like super powerful. But then there are other books that I think will, for the individual, just provide even more of a shift in thinking. And that would be, for example, Hans Hermann Hoppe's Democracy, the God That Failed. I mean, that's going to shake your assumptions to the core, and it's going to devour your entire mindset if you're a statist and deep-held Keynesian, right? It just shows you that democracy is utmost evil to the core, and Hoppe does not pull any punches. So that's kind of a huge red pill book as well. So the summary is, there are just too many. I can't explain one.
Right, right. Yeah, but would you start with Man, Economy, and State?
I mean, it kind of depends. I wouldn't give it to someone who's not interested in economics or interested in reading serious books. Probably not. For something like this, What Has Government Done to Our Money from Murray Rothbard is great, like a short pamphlet. Anyone can read that probably in a day, and explains monetary theories succinctly and perfectly, and explains Bitcoin perfectly. A fun fact, on the Word Crypto Network, I have a video where I read What Has Government Done to Our Money by Murray Rothbard, but I change the word gold for Bitcoin. And I'm telling you, this book is, like, just by changing these two words, it's even better than the Bitcoin Standard. Like, it's just, it explains Bitcoin so perfectly. It's incredible.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
1980s or something. Or Economics in One Lesson by Hazlitt. Right? That's also a nice general starting point. But again, Man, Economy, and State has everything. If you ever only read one book about economics and praxeology, Man, Economy, and State is it. But it's going to take you like 2 months to read.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, that is kind of what I was looking for, is, a shorter, more digestible read to start with. So yeah, what has government done to our money is, I think, a great suggestion. I also really like Economics in One Lesson, which is not necessarily part of the Austrian economics canon or whatever, but is a great way to sort of unlearn the default Keynesian assumptions that you have probably been instilled with.
Yeah, exactly. No, and Hazlitt is a fantastic writer. He was a a newspaperman, right? He, I think he even owned the newspaper and was writing there a lot, and newsletters and book reviews and so on. And he was a great benefiter and sponsor to Mises, actually paid him a decent amount of money regularly so that Mises could continue his research. So Hazlitt is I would say, really at the core of the foundation of Austrian economics.
So you are helping to coordinate this hackers conference that will be happening in the next couple of weeks. I think is it next weekend? Not this coming weekend, the weekend after. Is that correct?
No, it's
or is it this weekend?
Couple days. It's October 2nd till 4th.
All right. Nice.
So yes.
It's so this will drop on the 1st, so the day before the conference starts. Yeah. So we might get some people listening to this. Before the conference starts, but I would love to hear how you're involved, what can be expected in terms of like content coming out of the conference, where can people follow along? Is there a live stream or is there going to be content posted afterwards somewhere that people can consume?
Yes. So I've personally have been following the Hackers, or well, not in general, the Hackers Congress started in 2014. Together with Parallelnipolis, which Parallelnipolis is a combination of the Solthoven art group in Prague, as well as the Institute of Crypto Anarchy. They both got together and built this Parallelnipolis building, which I'm, by the way, sitting in right now and recording. And they, from that first year in 2014, first of all, they always demand to be paid in Bitcoin. You cannot pay in fiat. They have never accepted a fiat payment. They've never, ever had a bank account. Very first principle, the anarchists. They built the Bitcoin Cafe. So this was the first place, and for a very long time, the only place where fiat was not accepted, where you actually only could pay in Bitcoin. And then they started this Hackers Congress, which was an annual technology conference, a crypto anarchy conference, a congress of freedom-loving individuals getting together to build the weapons of defense that they would like to have themselves. And this is just such a beautiful event. And I've been following the last happening, so the last four of them, live, two of them in cyberspace and two of them in meatspace. And by now I've watched the recordings of all the talks from the past. It's just so damn good. I mean, it's incredibly smart minds coming to share their knowledge and to speak. And it's a really, 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 really valuable conference.
That's excellent. I'm excited to see what comes out of it. I know that some other Bitcoiners, Bitcoin podcasters will be involved. And so you guys can watch for content dropping out of the Hackers Conference. I think it's a really important event and messages that we need to hear and spread, especially at this time in the world. So yeah. Max, thanks so much for joining me today, man. It was really good to catch up with you. And have fun on your nomadic life, however much longer it persists. It sounds like a great time. And I kind of wish I could be along for the ride with you.
Well, thanks very much, Brady, again, for the invitation. That was really nice. I enjoyed our conversation. It's always fun to talk to you. And also thank you for keeping up that podcast. It's really valuable to just have more and more people who spread that word and that message, as you said. So important, so powerful. But one more thing before I let go, very important for your listeners, right? Because as this gets released on Thursday, tomorrow the Hackers Congress starts. And so there are three stages, main stages with phenomenal talks, together with a applied workshop for the sovereign individual that builds layers of defense for in cyberspace and meatspace for individuals, which is great. And so these, you can get access to this knowledge already now live for this weekend at hcpp.cz. And specifically why I mentioned this to you guys, because with the Citizen Bitcoin discount code, again, Citizen Bitcoin, one word, you're going to get 50% off your tickets. And that's quite a substantial savings of SATs. I think, going to be quite fun.
50% off. That's fantastic. All right. Citizen Bitcoin is the code. And you should, if you are going to make it over there, which, it might be a last minute decision. It will be a last minute decision at this point, but I think it would be a fantastic time and a great choice to go and, you know, just really be stimulated and energized for the fight that we are in the midst of. And, you know, make no mistakes, it is a fight that we're in the midst of, and it's only going to, you know, increase in its intensity over the coming years. The state will not, you know, go silently into the night in terms of, you know, specifically giving up control of the money. So yeah, it's important to arm yourselves with these ideas and these tactics and tools you know, for the fight that's we are in now and that will be, you know, like I said, increasing in intensity in the coming years.
Yes, the First World War started in 1912 or 1913, where they opened the first central banks and issued the first passports. And since then, the First World War has never ended. And after this 100 year of war, finally, we have found the weapon of Bitcoin, which we can use to liberate individual lives and to finally defend property against these absolute tyrannical looters. So this is a war, and it has been ongoing for a long time. We're not the first people, and we won't be the last people to fight it. But for sure, we will fight.
Absolutely, Max. Thanks so much. Have fun at the conference. Take care, and I'll see you out there on Twitter.
Yes, thank you very much, Brady, again. Bye-bye.
Thanks to Max for joining me today. You can find Max on Twitter at HillebrandMax. That's at HillebrandMax. I am at Citizen Bitcoin on Bitcoin Twitter. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. Share it with your family and friends. Get them on board. The bull is coming. Sign them up with the Swan Force. SwanBitcoin.com/enlist. Grab your ref link and onboard your family and friends. You'll stack some sats as they are stacking the sats. Thanks again to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring this episode and to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the Citizen Bitcoin podcast in the feed. Check out my merch shop at layer1btc.com. Click on partners and then Citizen Bitcoin. There's cool stuff there to check out. Shout out to Nick Ward, the designer and Bitcoiner who runs the show there. And check out the podcast I've created for Swan. Mentioned at the top, we've got Robert Breedlove and Parker Lewis on next week and the following week. Chad Saylor, Michael Saylor, and Danielle DiMartino Booth. It's going to be fire episode. Subscribe at swansignalpodcast.com and youtube.com/swansignal. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. Love talking to you all. My DMs are open on Twitter. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram. All right, that's it for this week. Take care of their Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.